Yo, welcome to another episode of Simply Bitcoin IRL. Very special show. Had this planned out for a couple weeks now. Earlier on today, I was like, it's just going to be me and Matt. And then Ben showed up. So back to the original show. It's going to be Matt, the legendary Matt Odell, and the legendary Ben Gagnon. I got the last name right. Anyways, before we start the show, I want to give a very special shout out to the person or the company that powers this podcast. Guys, check out swanbitcoin.com. It's the best place to buy Bitcoin. Any sizes from $10 to $10 million. They incentivize dollar cost averaging, and they also incentivize dollar cost averaging. Self-custody. They don't even have a sell button. Check out swanbitcoin.com. Do it right now. Anyways, I want to introduce our guests. Odell, how you doing, Matt?
What's up? Happy to be here.
Happy to have you, man. Let me ask you something. Out of 1 through 10, how humble are you feeling right now?
Which one's the most humble?
10? I'm the most humblest, so that's impossible.
No, but is 10 the most humble or is 1 the most humble?
One is least. That's kind of like the mempool debate.
I'm a 6.
I don't know which way, but I like that. Okay. All right. Okay. Good answer. And Ben Gagnon, I just learned how to pronounce his last name. Ben, how you doing? For anyone that doesn't know, Ben is the badass in charge. He's the chief mining officer at Bitfarms. How you doing, Ben?
Doing good. How are you guys doing?
Happy to have you. Happy to have you guys. So the reason, you know, I wanted to have this is because, you know, and I put this in the title of today's video. We are definitely entering the Then They Fight You stage. It's become incredibly obvious, you know, whether that's the White House report, the digital assets framework, the regulatory attacks. Also been talking to people in the background. And they also are saying, you know, this is serious. So I wanted to get both you guys together. Also want to talk about the mining centralization, the hash rate centralization specifically in the United States, and that how that could potentially become a vulnerability that specifically the U.S. Treasury, specifically also the Office of Foreign Asset Control, could potentially exploit, could potentially, you know, use to their advantage. So let's start off with that. Let's start off with Ben. Ben, what are your thoughts on let's start off with the digital assets framework, right? What are your thoughts on the White House report? Nick Carter did a great job at debunking a lot of that BS. So from your perspective, you know, working at a public mining company, what are your thoughts on it?
Well, you know, I don't think there's anything surprising in there, right? It's the same arguments, it's the same ideas, it's the same different groups like DigiEconomists that are cited over and over and over again. So nothing new or nothing groundbreaking. Obviously, Nick Carter's going to provide, you know, one of the best takedowns every single time. But the reality is that I think that for years we have kind of hid under the table as an industry. We haven't really wanted to go out and get any more attention. We wanted to remain in the shadows and just operate our business and just not draw any attention. And with the emergence of the publicly traded miners, especially, and all this attention on these large scale industrial operations that are raising so much cash, that is no longer really an option for a lot of companies. And so I think, you know, we're going out there. I think a lot of other companies are going out there. And when you do that, what shocks me is just how little experience I actually have with Bitcoin mining or industry. Most of the time when we've been speaking both with regulators in Canada and the United States, it's like, you know, they've never even seen a photo of Bitcoin mining. So to talk about actually going in there and creating legislation that's going to regulate an industry, you've never even seen a photo of that industrial activity taking place. Yeah, I just think it shows exactly where we're at right now, which makes me very bullish. Like, all of this is based off of nothing, and we've got a great story as an industry.
So, you know, obviously Odell and I are going to take a more, you know, they're trying to take our shit type of approach. So Matt, what was your take? I've never asked you this, actually. What was your take on the digital assets framework by the White House? I think Saylor at one point, not his words, not mine, literally called it, quote, propaganda. So what are your thoughts on it?
I mean, I would agree with Ben that it showed a gross misunderstanding of how Bitcoin mining works and how it functions as an industry and how it will interact with the energy grid in America. That part is not surprising. I mean, we've seen countless times regulators and policymakers be completely detached from reality in the things they try and do, regardless of industry. You know, we notice that in Bitcoin more as Bitcoiners because we understand it really well. I forget what the there's a law. I don't know where, like, if you understand a topic and you read journalism based on that topic, you see the gross mistakes that are made. And I would say this similar thing happens with policymakers. Now, the concern to me stems from a much more core base of concern rather than that actual report. And that is the U.S. government is known to regulate things that they don't understand. They've known to act in short-sighted ways that hurt our country and hurt, you know, average citizens. And they've been known to specifically go very burdensome in terms of financial regulation. And so the fact that government was even paying attention enough to write this report, to me, is like, it's a first step in a bad direction. And, but maybe it didn't even, like, it, to me, it didn't really change much. It's what was to be expected. If anything, that report was released later than I would have expected. Like, I would have expected the attention to come sooner rather than when it did.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, in the way that I'm seeing it, and again, it's perhaps because the way that I'm looking at this, this is definitely the then they fight you stage. The way that I'm looking at it, and to kind of go back to what you were saying, Odell, are these truly mistakes or is this malicious? And the reason I'm saying that is because, you know, Nick Carter did great, right? The sources that this report specifically used were sources that have been debunked. They weren't academic sources. And it's almost as, and it's not like they didn't talk to the Bitcoin Policy Institute. It's not like they weren't talking to Coin Center before this was released, and they released it anyways. And that leads me to believe this is malicious. I know it's going to be hard for Ben to touch on that, but Matt, what are your thoughts on that specifically?
I would lean to more incompetence than malintent. There's definitely some maliciousness in there, but I'm pretty much reading it as incompetence.
And Ben, I'll change the question. What could the industry do as a whole to make sure that this incompetence does not happen in the future? At least regulators and policymakers are more well informed so that they don't, you know, destroy a potential upcoming industry.
Yeah, I think the big thing is that you actually go out there and we engage and we educate people. There is a huge, big industry out here, and it's full of some of the most intelligent, most dedicated, most passionate individuals. And that stuff really shines through when you go and have one of these people go and give you a tour of their facilities. You know, so it's going to be about engaging with regulators, policymakers, state reps, you know, those sorts of things, and actually showing what we're actually doing out here, showing the good value, showing the economic contribution that's happening in the local communities that we're operating in, and really just proving our case, because everything is based on a bunch of crummy data. We have all of the right information and all of the, you know, the good facts on our side. Really, it's just about us going out there and actually making sure that they're seen.
Absolutely. So let's pivot a little bit towards specifically, you know, the after the CCP, specifically the Chinese Communist Party, banned Bitcoin mining in mainland China, right? We saw the mass hash migration. And we saw that really over the last 2-3 years. Because of that, you know, there's a good amount of hash rate in the United States now. And I think any type, regardless of the country, anytime there's an over, you know, this is what sucked about the mining centralization in China as well, right? It didn't sit well with me, and it looks like history is now repeating itself. And potentially that could be a vulnerability. I know that Stratum V2 changes the dynamics of that a little bit, but Odell, what are your thoughts on that? I know you've been vocal about this on Twitter.
Yeah, I mean, so you nailed it when it comes down to you don't want to have, you really don't want one entity, one geographic location, one jurisdiction to dominate hash rate. You want it to be as distributed as possible. Right now in America, we're at about, it's hard to tell for sure, but I mean, my guess would be around like 35% to 40% of hash is in America. Foundry alone, the largest mining pool in the world, is right now is at like 28% of hash. Foundry's customers are mostly large mining operators, publicly traded mining operators, you know, these big warehouse types of mining operations, and they KYC all of their operators. So everyone that uses that pool is known to them and presumably could get pressured indirectly by the government. So the concern is, okay, it can go both ways, right? Having a large amount of hash in America means we have a large amount of industry in America. It means we have a large amount of money behind Bitcoin mining. It means that there's all these different programs that are working to improve our energy generation and transmission and grid system in America behind Bitcoin mining. So if they work together, if that industry works together, maybe they will have a larger voice in Washington with policy. Now, the concern is, to me, is similar to the concern we saw with exchanges, which is this idea that, you know, maybe the U.S. government doesn't full out ban mining. I don't expect a federal proof of work ban, for instance, where they just straight up ban industry. And if they did, it would suck. It would suck for any Bitcoin miners in America. It would suck for companies based here. It would suck for investors based here. Some of them would move. Some of them would survive. Some would sell their hash to other places. But Bitcoin would be fine if there was a full-on ban. The bigger risk is if there's some kind of censorship regime that gets pushed onto miners, and miners choose to go along with that to essentially save their business in the short term, rather than thinking about the long-term repercussions of having a large amount of hash actively censoring transactions.
Ben, do you want to chime in on that? Does it worry you at all, you know, particularly from your situation, from your vantage point? Does it worry you about this hash rate concentration in the United States? And if I'm not mistaken, I know that Bitfarms, you guys are branching out. You guys are no longer also in the United States. I know you guys are mainly in Canada, but you guys are also looking in places that are not in North America. Is that correct?
Yeah, we have 10 different farms in 4 countries right now. So we're spread out across the world. But, you know, when it comes to decentralization, it happens in lots of different ways. You know, physically, I think moving out of China, especially with the capabilities that the Chinese have with regards to controlling, you know, internal internet traffic in China, it seems like a much bigger improvement to be outside of China and into the United States. And it's not as if that we have such a huge, you know, centralization within North America. Sure, there's been a huge increase in North America, but it's taken a part in all sorts of different states. You'll see that number for how many applications are out in Texas, but the actual real demand in Texas is probably just shy of a gigawatt. And so you're looking at, you know, Texas has a decent amount, Washington State, decent amount, Georgia, the Carolinas, Quebec, New York, all these areas, you know, that have decent amount of hash rate. And they're all subject to different rules. They're all subject to different, you know, bodies of enforcement agents and everything else. So there's all sorts of different ways to even spread it out, even within North America. And, you know, personally, I think the institutionalization of Bitcoin mining kind of has to happen. You don't get a large product like aluminum without having large publicly traded mining companies who are, you know, active in the producing of that good, the storage of that good, the transacting of that good. Like, it just doesn't happen. For these industries to get large and institutional scale, you have to have institutional grade miners. And in order to have the capital at those levels, like, you go public and you comply with those rules. So, you know, that's a natural evolution of this industry, and it's bullish for this industry rolling forward, because you're going to need that level of security to get the Goldmans of the world in Bitcoin. You're not going to get it, you know, if you just have security that's completely reliant on garages, you know, distributed around the world. They're not going to buy into that.
Yeah, and I agree with that. But the crux of the issue is the Treasury going to go along with that? Because, you know, as we saw with the recent move by the Treasury, for the first time sanctioning not individual, not in the government, but open source software. I would like to make the argument that they did that as a precedent for the future. And it was Odell's amazing tweet. I've been using it the last 3-4 weeks. A blog post resulted in the majority of Ethereum validators actively censoring for the US government, right? So, you know, the Treasury is just not going to go gently into that good night. They stand the most to lose. So, kind of combining what you were just saying, and I'm going to pass this to Odell and get his thoughts. I don't want to ask this question to Ben. So I'm going to pass this to Odell. Odell, is that possible? Is that possible? Is it possible to have this giant public mining sector, but also staying in the good graces of governments, of specifically the U.S. government?
Well, to be clear, you know, this is not it's not a short term risk I'm concerned about. It's not something that I think is super, you know, necessarily super likely to happen or a major threat. It's something to pay attention to, right? And it's a trend to pay attention to. The concern, even at 35% to 40% of the hash, is obviously way less than if that hash increases. And it's not necessarily just in U.S. jurisdiction. It's basically, I would go as far as saying U.S. and allies, large operations, publicly traded companies, on-grid operations with big warehouses, you know, the type of operations that are easier to enforce this type of, these types of rules, right? The amount of hash that is controlled by those in specific jurisdictions that are all working together that often implement heavy-handed financial regulation, you don't want a high number of that. As long as we have miners, a decent amount of hash of miners that are not following those rules, they will mine the transactions if the censoring miners aren't mining those transactions.
Go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, so I 100% agree with Ben that the trend is going to, you know, industrialized mining operations, massive mining operations. We see that happening. 100, you know, that makes sense to me. I do think that there is, at a certain level, there's diseconomies of scale that we haven't quite hit yet, that maybe we're starting to feel, which is this, you know, how much cheap energy you can get at a source, right? It's, you know, energy is not, and energy at different sources is finite. You can only get so much cheap energy at certain sources. And then on top of that, when you start talking about waste heat, when you start talking about recapturing waste heat, particularly that is easier to do on smaller scales than at large scale. So I do think there's some elements of diseconomies of scale that will help us in the medium to long term. Now, the question really is, will Treasury tell large miners that they can't include certain transactions in their blocks? And I think that's probably likely. I think that's probably going to happen. I think those a lot of miners will comply with that. And they just won't include those transactions in their blocks, but other miners will. But I think it's also prudent for people in this industry that are operating these large businesses to push back to a degree, right? And to also insulate themselves from the kind of pressure that can happen. So we see a lot of times in online businesses, reduce the amount of data that you have on your users so that if you are compelled to hand over things, you don't have as much data to hand over. You can only hand over what you have. It reduces your liability. What we're seeing with Foundry, for instance, Foundry, the largest mining pool in the world, is they're sponsoring Stratum V2 development. And I personally believe that one of the reasons that they're funding Stratum V2 development is because they want to be in a position where they're not actually constructing the blocks as the pool operator. Obviously, so right now how we have it set up is the pool operator is deciding which transactions get put in a block, and then the miners are just following along with that. Now, if the miners in that pool don't like what's happening by the pool operator, they have a soft exit, soft veto. They can leave and go to another pool, but they don't get to actively be part of that process of which blocks go into that pool. So right now, the most obvious, like easiest method would be to essentially like knock on Foundry's door and be like, don't include these transactions in blocks. Those transactions will still get included in other blocks by other miners, presumably at a higher fee because the large miners aren't including it, but they would still get included in. Now, Treasury could take it a step further and say, you cannot build on top of blocks that have the censored transaction, essentially attempting to reorg any miners that are mining censored transactions. I don't think they'd go that far, at least and not anytime soon. But partially, that's only because I think they're just not quite there yet in their understanding of the system. I think we should assume the worst.
Well, and it was actually someone in the comments that gave me the inspiration to ask this question. Shout out Bitcoin Shooter. Will they force a fork? Will a U.S. OFA whatever approved, you know, instead of BSV?
OFAC?
OFAC Bitcoin versus Bitcoin.
I mean, look, obviously miners wouldn't want that to happen. So I think, you know.
Sorry, Ben. I saw you opening your mouth and I muted you
because of the ice. I'm going to say no, it's not going to happen because the miners will respond fast enough. And I think there's a lot of legal differences here that people don't understand, you know, when it comes to actually what miners are doing and how they interact with the pool and what they get paid for, right? You know, it's very easy for us to just shift our hash rate over to a different country and a different legal jurisdiction. Where's the Bitcoin mining actually taking place, right? Is it taking place at the pool level? Is it taking place where, you know, the physical miners are actually doing the work? Like, where's the work happening, right? There's an aggregation that's taking place at the pool level. All we're doing is just processing whatever we get sent, just like Matt was talking about. It's very easy for us to send the value of our hash rate somewhere else, right? Instantaneously to a different jurisdiction where different rules apply, right? All we care about as a large scale institutional miner is that I'm getting the most value out of my computational power, right? That's what I care about. I care that I'm getting the max revenue that I'm getting, that's possible for me to get out of my Terahash. And, you know, I'm not going to get that if I have to skip out on a bunch of transactions. You know, that would be my assumption. My assumption is if these transactions are being blocked somewhere else, they're paying a pretty nice transaction fee. They should be included in blocks. I do want to process them. Miners will just adapt around this and we'll just shift with that network hash rate.
So what you're suggesting, I mean, but does this mean shift as in actually moving the physical location of these machines to a better jurisdiction? Because I get it from a free market perspective, right? It's like, obviously, you know, I'm just going to mine the chain or thing that's going to be the most economical to me. But and this reminds me of this law that was just passed in Europe. Right, where they're forcing iPhones to use USB chargers instead of the Lightning port, and that is going to be a huge loss of revenue for Apple, right? What I'm trying to say is that sometimes governments don't give a flying F when it comes to profit, right? So what would you say to that?
Corporate structures have a really good way of solving, you know, the problems that have been caused by governments. And so, you know, there's ways that you set up your company and your operations in order to shield yourself from certain, you know, risks, liabilities, costs, those sorts of things, right? Now, like if you look at how an actual mining operation is structured, a lot of the time you have a mining company that has two different subsidiaries. One is doing the actual hosting operation for the other subsidiary, which just owns the miners and, you know, is in a contractual obligation with the hosting company to operate its own equipment. Now you're one company, it's all the same thing, but because of how you want to structure things for legal and tax purposes, that's how you set it up. And there's a million ways that you can use, you know, different legal and corporate structures in order to change your legal implications. And the reality is that they'll just move that hash rate. They'll just change the legal structure. It's just going to morph around it, whatever it is.
Awesome. Matt, you want to add to that before we move on?
I just, it's interesting having this conversation right now because, this conversation has been happening more. It's been more common, which is good to see. I mean, look, we should be always thinking about worst case scenarios, period. It's healthy. Always in this kind of system, in a system like Bitcoin, where it is operating in the most adversarial of environments, where it needs to be robust and needs to have, you know, as close to 24/7 uptime as possible that can withstand the largest government attacks, that you have to assume the worst, always. You just always have to assume the worst. But it's interesting talking about it right now because the last 6 months while having this conversation, it was in a situation where we saw a massive increase in hash controlled by publicly traded miners. And publicly traded miners, why do I call them out? Is because specifically, they're the easier types of firms to regulate. They're already completely wrapped up in the bureaucracy. We've seen a massive increase in that hash rate, and they were incentivized essentially over more sovereign miners because they were able to get such cheap debt. So they were able to expand super quickly in the bull market on cheap debt that no one else could get or that the smaller operators had more trouble getting. And now that's all kind of unwinding. We're seeing a lot of them fail. And it's going to be kind of a survival of the fittest. But the question is, does that hash distribute? And my guess is that it does not. My guess is we're going to see a few big players rise from the ashes of this bear market in America specifically that control a large, large amount of hash under one corporation, under one publicly traded corporation. But depending on how that rolls out, like depending if it happens that way or if it actually distributes, we're in a completely different situation in 8 months, 12 months.
So let's talk about nature healing itself. And what I mean that, I mean the, forgive my language, the absolute clusterfuck of the Celsius debacle and one of the largest public Bitcoin mining companies in the world basically, I know they technically didn't declare bankruptcy, but like, I'm not going to pay back my loans type of thing. And for anyone who
doesn't
know,
they're about to declare bankruptcy. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, man. I'm trying to be nice. Remember, I'm the most humblest. Just want to let you know. So I want to keep saying that in front of Matt.
You're a one on the humble scale.
I don't know. See, it depends on how you look at the scale. That might be the most humblest, or that might not be. I'll never know. Anyways, okay. So back to this. Ben, what are your thoughts on this, man? Was this avoidable by Core Scientific? And could you explain to everybody, because you're in the trenches, you see what's going on. Why did this happen to Core Scientific?
Yeah, so first, just touching off of what Matt said there, you know, there's one really cool thing that I do like about the public companies, and that's the decentralization of ownership. You know, there's an opportunity here through traditional vehicles like public companies, public shares, for investors to get access to hash rate and industrial scale mining economics in a way they've never really been able to do before. Now, granted, you still have to work through your counterparty and your counterparty risk, and trying to identify the correct counterparty in this market is no easy feat for anybody, even a seasoned pro. But you know, the reality is that, you know, for companies like us, we've got 80,000 retail shareholders. So we have taken roughly 2% of the Bitcoin network hash rate, and we spread it out over 80,000 plus shareholders, right? So that's a huge decentralization of the network hash rate, you know, from what it could have been previously without public companies and everything just being private and being smaller players. So I think that's a really cool thing. And Nico, I totally forgot your second question.
Yeah, specifically as it relates to Core Scientific.
Right, Core Scientific. How did I forget that question?
Okay.
Not on the spot. You know, well, I think the writing was on the wall with Compute North when that came out. This is the light at the end of the tunnel. We needed to see some capitulation in the market, because there was a time in the mining space where people were going after insane levels of growth for any price. And that is not sustainable. We cannot have that. This market is too competitive. It's too brutal. And so when we had a pullback, you know, down to 20K, we started seeing, you know, mining economics that we haven't seen since 2020. You know, people are starting to look at this and they're saying, holy shit, you know, I'm in over my head. This sort of thing needed to happen. Unfortunately, more of it needs to happen as well. But this is a necessary step before we can take off again as an industry. So I think this is painful, but this is overall, this is the market healing itself. This is the self-healing element of free markets and natures that you were talking about, Nico.
Yeah, it's good. It's interesting because I was there 2018 and you're seeing the same thing happen. It's just on a much bigger scale because there's a lot more public mining companies mining Bitcoin. And just it's interesting to see history repeating itself was what I'm trying to say. But it's so funny, the headlines, and it was to something that you were saying earlier, Odell. It's like when you have, I hate using the word expertise. I absolutely despise it. But when, let's say you, fine, I'm going to use it because I can't think of any other word right now. When you have the expertise of a specific subject matter and you're reading the journalism top covering that specific subject matter, you're just like, this is BS. But watching the sensationalist headlines in relation to Core Scientific, it's just like, no, man, this is a good thing. This is a good thing. We have about 25 minutes left. I want to use the rest of the time talking about the future. You're talking about a lot of negativity today. So I'm going to give two examples. We've seen this in the last 2 years. We've seen ExxonMobil using Coosaw Energy, which recently just acquired Great American Mining. And we saw Gazprom, which is the state-owned. Ben's laughing. I want to know why. What do you know that we don't know, Ben?
Isn't it Crusoe?
I butchered your last name. What makes you think I know how to pronounce that? Oh man.
How'd you pronounce it?
Crusoe. I said Crusoe.
No, right? You were way off.
Crusoe.
He was way off. I can't remember how he said it now, but it really stuck out in my mind as being way off.
Remember to go back and check the tapes.
Hey, English is my second language. I have no shame. Did you guys understand what I had to say? Yeah. My mom has a huge accent, and she gets shit done. And anyways, I'm getting sidetracked. Back to subject matter. Gazprom, yes. Russian state-owned energy company. And it was announced also that they were using, it's funny because they were using the company that...
They're using Compass Miners.
The Compass Miners, they're using the company that Compass was using to...
It was BitRiver.
Yeah, it was BitRiver. So clearly, you had interest.
Free ASICs out of the deal.
Yeah, it's perfect. Worked out great. Ben, what are your thoughts on that, man? You know what? If you've been in this long enough, you're like, that was obvious. But it still doesn't take away from the holy crap moment. Just like when they made legal tender in El Salvador, you're like, this was always coming, but it never. Dude, you're still like in shock when it actually happened. So, Ben, first question, were you surprised? And second question, is this going to keep happening? And if it is, how so?
Not surprised at all. This is the natural evolution of things. Bitcoin is really, really disruptive to energy markets because it allows you to access international markets digitally. Without that physical infrastructure that it's taken to physically transport the energy, now you just transport the value. That's transformative for a lot of different areas. And so you will think that is going to spread. I would think also that the facilities that you generally see people building today are not going to be the facilities that are going to be powering the Bitcoin network. And probably, three halving cycles from now, it's going to be very, very different. If you look at where Bitcoin mining is the most profitable and the most advantageous with like the existing synergies. You look at like a normal, distribution curve, the vast majority of that energy underneath that curve is not something that's going to make sense for Bitcoin. Bitcoin makes sense kind of in these like weird tail end scenarios where, they're monetizing some sort of weird market dynamic or weird inefficiency in the market. And that's where that makes sense. So Gazprom should be doing it. All energy companies are going to be doing this. I will think that, in the future, all power plants and kind of transmission level infrastructure, you're going to have small Bitcoin mines there that are just there kind of as load banks, ramping up, ramping down, and trying to monetize that last little bit of excess supply on the line.
Matt, you want to add to that? You're a slave to the news cycle just as much as I am, my friend, because you do rabbit hole recap, so you know exactly what's going on. Even with check out rabbit hole recap. Even with my mispronunciation, you're so plugged in. You're like, I know what he's talking about.
Also because Marty was neck deep in, working for Great American Mining for a while. And Crusoe is, there's a lot of question marks around them right now, particularly in flared gas mining. I think more of it will become public going forward, but they've specifically been very malicious with their patents. And it's a very troubling sign because flared gas is one of the coolest subsets of Bitcoin mining, and it will significantly distribute mining, and it already has. You can have like a few wells on your property, and you can just connect that to internet, use it to power a generator, and all of a sudden you're mining Bitcoin off grid.
Okay, but hold on, Ben. I'm sorry to interrupt you because I'm very curious. From my understanding, and I might be wrong here, is flared gas viable without the government incentives? Because we know, for example, that the government is like, okay.
That's the cool part. The cool part is up until this point, energy producers have been forced by regulation to flare. And a lot of them don't listen to that because it just costs them money and it's hard to enforce. Like, you have to be out on the site to see if they're actually flaring the amount they're supposed to be flaring. Now, instead of just letting that gas go, right? When they don't flare it, they just vent it. And if they do flare it, they're literally burning money. Instead of doing that, they have a direct incentive not to vent it. They have a direct incentive to turn it into real money, to turn it into Bitcoin. So not only is it extremely powerful on the incentive side, it's good for the environment. And it's just great for energy producers. But my point is, the cool part about it to me is that it inherently distributes mining. Having a company going around trying to centralize that via patent trolling is a concern that people should be concerned about. So more on that will kind of come out over the next 6 months, my guess is, because obviously other flared gas mining operations are not happy about that. On the Exxon, it's cool seeing Exxon involved. I mean, Exxon's obviously one of the most valuable companies in the world. So that's obviously, you know, a bullish sign of legitimacy for it. The freaks know, my listeners know, that my dad is a massive ride or die Exxon bull. So to him, there was a lot of legitimacy added on that. And then on the Gazprom side, I think the Gazprom side is exactly what we expected to see, which is like nation state mining operations. And if we see more of those, then all of a sudden we hedge our risks on America, for instance, having too much hash rate that might be under regulatory captures kind of situation. So, I mean, I think it's on the Bitcoin side, it's really great to see, you know, nation states that are necessarily not aligned or allied with America also adopt mining so that we have more distribution globally. But it is really fucked up because they're literally mining with people's Compass miners because the U.S. government sanctioned BitRiver. And then the Compass was like, oh, we can't get your miners out. So then BitRiver just presumably took the miners and now Gazprom is using those. So sucks.
Oh, man. So
crazy times we live in.
Yes.
I did not expect this timeline.
No.
That's the funniest timeline, though.
Yeah, it just keeps getting more interesting. Oh, this is a funny comment. Odell, I'm sorry. I have to do this. By Bitcoin user XXX. I discovered Odell the day they invited Sailor on BTC Sessions. He was drunk. AF. Very funny episode. Now I want to see that. That's not fair.
You haven't seen that episode?
No.
It was at the first top. And I was just drunkenly yelling at Tina, calling him a bear. Bitcoin Tina, and I was right about Bitcoin Tina being a bear. I mean, I was definitely wrong about the drunk price calls I made in that episode. But it was a long day of content for me. I think I did RHR, then I did like Swan Signal, and then I like jumped into that at the tail end of that stream, and I was just way too drunk, way too bullish, not humble at all. But Tina was a bear. I was correct on that.
Yeah, the shows are attacked. This is my fourth show today, my bros. I did Simply, Lynn Alden, then Jeff Booth, then you guys are my fourth. But Ben was able to make it, so it was a nice little cherry on top. Okay, going back to in terms of the flared gas stuff, and I want to tie it in with you, Ben, and Bitfarms. What renewable energy does Bitfarms use? And do you guys see yourselves using flared gas in the future?
I like hydro. Hydro is my favorite one.
Why?
You know, usually huge amounts of excess capacity built out for industrial demand, which is gone. So, you know, you have no other way to move this asset other than through inefficient transmission lines. Usually deprecated, you know, amortized, paid off asset, very little to keep it operational. I really like hydro. I think it's the best cost effective renewable asset. You don't have any of the, you know, the intermittency issues that you have with solar or wind. Beyond that, I would be really interested in geothermal projects if there were, you know, any that were sizable and cost effective. I really like geothermal as well, but generally speaking, they've just been a little bit too expensive and out of that price range. And if I can just comment a little bit on the geopolitics thing that you brought up, because I think that's the most interesting element of where we are today in the Bitcoin mining, you know, wars that we have going on right now. Like China banning Bitcoin mining is such a massive geopolitical shift, and I don't think people understand it. You know, the fact that Gazprom and Russia is doing mining, the fact that you've got places like Iran doing mining, the United States is doing mining, you've got areas like you've got ADQ in Abu Dhabi, and you've got the other group that's just an hour and a half, you know, away in Dubai, who's doing 600 megawatts of mining. So you've got what's supposed to be an announcement to do 2.6 gigawatts worth of mining in UAE alone. You know, that's 26% of current power consumption for the entire network. And they've got ways to keep their costs artificially low, right? Like this geopolitics angle is super interesting. And if it's not happening in the United States, then, you know, you start thinking about the areas where this hash rate is going to be going, and it's likely going to be some pretty rough areas.
Myself muted. So let's talk about.
It's gonna be fucking awesome watching it all play out.
Yeah, man. And Matt and I have front row seats, and we're the fucking vanguard. We're the ones that are gonna get actually beat up. Okay. Oh Jesus. Okay. Anyways,
I don't know about that. Ben's got a whole business on the line over here.
Yeah. But we're excuse my language, guys. We're the dumb motherfuckers being the faces of it. So yeah, it's going to be interesting. Okay. So, let's talk about mining, manufacturing, centralization, right? We know that the biggest, mining manufacturers right now, it's WhatsMiner, Bitmain, right? I know that they made announcements that they're manufacturing now. I think WhatsMiner made an announcement that they're manufacturing in the U.S., but we still know that the vast majority is made specifically in the Shenzhen region, right? So do you see that as an issue, Ben, that the vast majority of Bitcoin ASICs are made in a country that is actively hostile towards not only Bitcoin mining, but just Bitcoin in general?
So I think you have a couple of things going on there. One, we've got so much hardware sitting there in our market right now that, you know, we could stop producing miners tomorrow and we'd still have a backlog of miners for many, many months to go. So I don't think that's an immediate concern. In terms of it being more of a long-term concern, you know, this market is really ripe for disruption. That's why I was so glad to see Intel come out last year with their chips. You know, Bitmain and MicroBT produce the vast majority of miners out there globally. And, you know, they've all shifted the vast majority of their production outside of mainland China already. So I think the vast majority for both of those is being done in Southeast Asia, whether that's Thailand, Indonesia, Malaysia, or a couple of other, you know, countries which are also contributing to the mix. This is what I was talking about earlier with those corporate structures and legal structures. You know, these Trump 301 duties really came into effect. And within a couple of months, you know, I think within, you know, case of our industry, it was probably something like 12 to 18 months later, we had a huge, massive shift of manufacturing that started to move for the first time ever. So, you know, that we'll see that every single time there's a bull market, we're going to see a massive amount of people coming into the space trying to disrupt the established Bitcoin miners trying to gain an edge. It's very expensive to do that. I like to see people continuing to try and keep the space nice and fresh. But you won't find me signing up any checks anytime soon for a new Bitcoin mining manufacturer fresh on the scene.
Speaking of new Bitcoin mining manufacturers fresh on the scene, I'm going to pass this to Odell, but first, we have a very important question, and if you guys know this inside joke, I think it came from BitBlock.
No, I want to ask the question to Ben.
Okay.
Ben, what percentage Ben, what percentage of global energy consumption will be used by Bitcoin mining in 30 years?
I think ignore we're still going to be still a fraction of 1%, right? Really? Know, we're right there between like 0.1 to maybe 0.2% right now. And you think about all the different halvings that we have, you know, that's going to take place in that time that are going to cut down that reward. We're going to be sub single Bitcoin block reward within that time. You know, like that's,
we're going to be why are you so bearish?
Period. I'm not bearish. I'm not bearish at all. But my point is that I think that, I think that Bitcoin mining has to, by definition, it has to move to marginal sources of electricity. It's the only way that this industry makes sense in the long term, is it's the buyer of last resort for electricity at all sorts of, you know, at all sorts of scales. And that's what it's doing with methane capture, flare gas mining. It's what we're doing with Quebec and our excess hydro plan and everything else. Like, we're taking advantage of power, and we're being a buyer of last resort for power that has no other purpose. And that's where you're going to make your money in the long term. You're not going to be able to be viable, I think, signing up to grid prices and just like paying what everybody's paying. Like, you're going to have some sort of a pricing edge like that.
Go for it, Matt. Go for it, bro.
I have not been.
You want to respond to that?
Just to
be no, honest. I just most miners I talk to are just extremely bearish on energy consumption. I don't understand it. Like, is in 30 years or whatever I said, what did I say, 20 years? Like, is Bitcoin the standard money of the world at that point? Or are we still?
I think so. I mean, but I don't think Bitcoin's ever going to be like single digit percentages of energy. I don't think it's necessary. What's necessary is from the security angle, that it's too costly and difficult for anybody to even come close to attempt to. It doesn't need to consume like X percentage of the world's energy, right? It needs to be able to withstand high levels and basically any reasonable level of attack.
Ben, do you do any home mining?
Not anymore.
Individual mining? No. Okay, I'll respect your OPSEC regardless. What, like, do you think in 20 years your family, your individual family's energy consumption will be larger than 50%? Energy consumption dedicated to Bitcoin.
An individual family's energy consumption, are they consuming will be more dedicated than 50% going to Bitcoin? Yeah. I think there's a lot of families where that'll definitely be true, because this is about, like I said, it's about capturing these weird market inefficiencies. It's about recycling those wastes. It's having that marginal cost of electricity. Things like, hey, you're going to use this electricity for heat. You might as well mine Bitcoin and offset your costs. Like, those are very compelling economics that are going to be true even if Bitcoin is very volatile, right? You know, you're offsetting
the cost. So then how does that?
But it's a marginal source of electricity, right? Like, that's, Bitcoin has to go to those kind of economics. You're not going to be signing up for like 8-cent power costs. Like, you're going to be sitting there doing grid balancing. You're going to be buying peak demand, you know, when it's not in peak demand. Like, that's what you're going to be doing, is you're going to be taking advantage
that still
of
counts,
those excesses.
That still counts the energy consumption percentage.
Yeah, but it's pretty small. Like, I mean, seriously, like right now we're 0.1 to 0.2% of the world's energy, which is why all this stuff is like so laughable. And you keep rolling this forward. It's like, how much can the energy really grow over the next 18 months until we have halving? Like, run those analyses in your head. Like, start running payback calculations for a new build out if you start today and when you turn it online 6 months from now, and then you've got halving 12 months after that. Like, you know, we're not going to be growing so fast with these kind of economic incentives, you know.
So Ben, I don't know if you know like where this question started, but it started It started on stage. We had a rabbit hole recap on stage at Bid Block Boom. And it was because, you know, Elizabeth Warren and all these different policymakers are saying Bitcoin uses too much energy. And obviously, we as an industry, we use very little of the energy mix. Like you said, it's like 0.1%, 0.2%, whatever. It's negligible. And a lot of miners argue, rather than arguing like it's a negligible amount, they argue we can use as much energy as we want. You shouldn't police our energy, right? But if you're a miner and you actually believe that after hyper-Bitcoinization, we're going to use less than 1%, then why are we even having this conversation? Like, it should just be, we are going to use negligible energy forever. But then
like, both of those are true, Matt, and everybody just has their own story they want to say, but they're both true.
Yeah. No, but what is true is in 30 years, my family's energy mix is going to be like 60% Bitcoin mining, 70% Bitcoin mining. Like, I just, that's what I expect my family's energy mix to be. Energy consumption mix, or if that's even a word. I don't even know that's a word.
I think it's going to be, you know, done more on like a utility level and utility scale. There's going to be for sure some home miners and some home situations. But I think most of the time where mining is really going to be happening is at distribution and transmission level. And you're going to have small little mines sitting outside substations. And when there's, you know, excess load capacity relative to demand, I think you're just going to start monetizing it with Bitcoin mining. Like I think that's inevitable. Like you can't,
that's obvious. Yeah.
In that transaction, and that's solving a problem that nobody ever thought was possible to fix. So like, I think that's the natural inevitable, you know, spot that fills in. And it's going to fill in lots of different voids.
In 100 years, like every boiler in America is going to have an ASIC in it.
And it should be. Why should you just generate heat just for generating heat? Like heat's the most common byproduct of a lot of different industrial, you know, processes. You know, that's just obvious, you know, a good way that you can save on economics.
Awesome, guys. That you guys just made my job a whole lot easier.
I love the cage match.
dude, it was great. So it's interesting because I had Marshall Long and Adamo, Denver Bitcoin, and I came and the same thing happened, bro. They just started going back and forth. But it lasted 30 minutes.
On that
minutes.
Topic?
No, dude, they're just, bro, talking about immersion mining, airflow mining. Oh, I'm going to send this to Adam.
The first time I ever started this question was with Adam. Like, Adam's is an under 1%er as well. So is Marty.
I mean, it's like, it's just the math, dude. You know, you run the math and you look at kind of what are watt per terahash efficiency assumptions, and you start getting, you know, pretty predictable levels of energy consumption, and we're not growing like the network grows because we're offset by efficiencies, right? And then you have that economic incentive. And so we're not a parabolic curve. Like we're a very jagged linear curve. And so that's just how it is. I can't imagine we're ever going to hit like 8% of the world's energy. And so, you know, these conversations are foolish for so many reasons. They're foolish because, like, one, you know, the predicted outcomes are just so unrealistic. And then the second, we're back in cage match. The second, because, like, you look at all these different things and it's like, wait a minute. If you actually understand any of this math, you'd understand that Bitcoin mining is probably improving and reducing emissions more than it's contributing to emissions. Like, you'd understand that this is providing a more positive impact than a negative one. You'd start running the math and say, okay, this is going to actually make things a lot worse if we go after it. It's pretty bizarre to me that this conversation is being had. And the fact that it is being had is another symptom of how early we are in this space. Because we're having conversations around like morality of energy use now, you know, like something that like, you know, like who knew this conversation was was, you know, open and available to us. But if we're going to start talking about morality of energy use, like, okay, you know, we can play that game about what's a more moral use of energy. I would say that securing the Bitcoin network and private property and freedoms for people around the world is a significant better use of energy than all of TikTok combined. You know, so we can start making those calculations and comparisons if people want to do that. How much energy does it take, you know, for selfies and all this other stuff that people use and don't need? So, yeah,
it's a foolish
argument in the first place, backed by the worst data. It's frustrating.
Okay. I've really enjoyed this, guys. I'm fucking exhausted. I really like this. Thank you guys for coming on. For anyone who's tuning in, we have the legendary Matt O'Dell and the legendary Ben Gagnon. Ah, I got his name right. Thank you for tuning into another episode of Simply Bitcoin IRL. We'll be back with the show tomorrow, 12:15 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Guys, please stay backstage. I'm going to roll out the credits. It doesn't take more than 10, 15 seconds. We'll be right back. Well, I mean, we'll be right back, but I'll see you guys tomorrow. Peace.
Which one's the best crypto asset? Well, Bitcoin's the best crypto asset. Okay. What's the second best? There is no second best.